From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My daughter, Rachel Corey, went to the Gaza Strip in January to join in solidarity with the Palestinian people in opposing the occupation there.
Today, we'll speak with the parents of Rachel Corey. She was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to prevent it from demolishing a home. We'll also speak with the parents of Tom Herndl. He lays in a coma, having been shot by the Israeli military, also in the occupied territories. This on the 36th anniversary of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The two top editors of the New York Times resigned yesterday after three major scandals. The Washington Post reports the resignations of New York Times executive editor Howell Raines and managing editor Gerald Boyd came after reporting scandals involving journalistic fraud and plagiarism called into question the judgment of the leadership of the nation's most influential newspaper. The New York Times itself cites plummeting newsroom morale. 5 weeks ago, the New York Times discovered that 27-year-old reporter Jason Blair had committed dozens of acts of fraud and plagiarism. Then veteran journalist Rick Bragg resigned after he admitted an unpaid assistant had done virtually all the reporting for a story for which he took full credit. Finally, the Washington Post published an internal email communication between Baghdad bureau chief John Burns and veteran reporter Judith Miller. Miller has written several stories citing a source claiming Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. In her email, she revealed the unnamed source was none other than Ahmed Chalabi, the CIA's point man for the Iraqi National Congress. Raines will be replaced by his immediate predecessor, Joseph Lelyveld. The paper's chair and publisher said neither Raines nor Boyd will hold any further official position with the newspaper. The Senate voted 94-2 yesterday to give millions of minimum wage families an increased child tax credit. Originally, they were cut out of the Bush administration's tax credit at the last minute. However, anticipating objections from the House, the Senate also allowed much wealthier families to receive the tax credit. The bill had originally phased out married couples making $110,000 or more. Now couples earning up to $200,000 can receive some of the tax credit. Just 3 days after the Justice Department's Inspector General found hundreds of immigrant detainees taken into custody, been mistreated and abused in detention facilities, Attorney General John Ashcroft urged Congress to give the Justice Department more power. He asked Congress to expand the USA Patriot Act to permit the government to hold more suspects indefinitely and to extend the death penalty to more people accused of terrorist crimes. Ashcroft held copies of extremist declarations of war against the U.S., read aloud the names of people killed in the September 11th attacks, and said the Justice Department does not apologize for its policies. Pro-choice lobby is suffering a major blow. The Congress voted 282-139 to outlaw a method of abortion sometimes used in the late stages of pregnancy. Opponents of the procedure call it partial birth abortion. The method is generally used only as a last resort when the fetus is fatally malformed. Under the bill, doctors performing the procedure will face fines up to 2 years in jail. The bill makes an exception when the woman's life is in danger, but provides no other allowances for her health. The Senate passed a nearly identical bill in March. President Bush praised the bill almost immediately, urging Congress to give him a final version as fast as possible so he can sign it into law. It's the most significant blow to advocates of a woman's right to choose in decades. United States and South Korea have agreed to the phased withdrawal of U.S. troops from the border between the North and the South. The presence of 14,000 U.S. troops there has long been seen as a way of preventing North Korean attack on the South because U.S. troops would be hit and therefore ensure a strong U.S. counterattack. The Guardian of London reports it's the first time U.S. troops will not occupy the region since the Korean War and that the redeployment raises the prospect of a U.S. strike on Pyongyang's nuclear facilities. United Nations nuclear inspectors arrive in Baghdad today to investigate the looting of material from Iraq's main nuclear facility. The director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed Al-Baradei, says a radiological emergency may be brewing after looters left behind piles of uranium and spilled radioactive materials. The U.S. originally tried to keep U.N. inspectors out of Iraq entirely. The U.S. has relented under pressure, but has limited the number of inspectors to 7, mandated that the inspectors must be out in 2 weeks, and is insisting that U.S. troops accompany them at the sites. Meanwhile, the charges are mounting that Britain doctored an intelligence report on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction in order to justify an invasion. An intelligence source has told the BBC the British government sent the report back to intelligence chiefs for changes 6 to 8 times. Prime Minister Tony Blair himself was involved. A dossier including the claim that Iraq could launch weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes was repeatedly returned to intelligence chiefs for changes, the BBC has learned. A source close to British intelligence has told BBC diplomatic correspondent Barnaby Mason that Downing Street returned draft versions of the dossier to the Joint Intelligence Committee 6 to 8 times. And in the U.S., the Washington Post is reporting Vice President Cheney and his most senior aide made multiple trips to the CIA over the past year to question analysts studying Iraq's weapons programs and alleged links to al-Qaeda. The Post reports senior intelligence officials said analysts felt pressured by Cheney's visits to fit their assessments with the Bush administration's policy objectives. This news from the occupied territories. Hamas has broken off its dialogue with Palestinian Prime Minister Abu Mazen. At Wednesday's peace summit in Jordan, Abu Mazen said the armed Palestinian uprising must end. A spokesperson for Hamas told the BBC the prime minister's promise had opened the door for Israel to kill Palestinians at will, and that Hamas had been left with no choice but to continue fighting Israel. The same spokesperson told the AFP Abu Mazen does not represent them and called for mass protests against the summit. Meanwhile, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat said yesterday Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had offered no tangible concessions at the summit. French special forces have arrived in the mineral-rich Bunia region of the Congo. Hundreds of people have been killed there over the last few weeks. An internal Environmental Protection Agency study has found that 1 out of every 4 of the nation's largest industrial plants and water treatment facilities are in serious violation of pollution standards at any one time, but only a fraction of them face formal enforcement actions. This, according to the Washington Post. The study found half the serious offenders exceeded pollution limits for toxic substances by more than 100%. The study showed some companies and municipalities have illegally discharged toxic chemicals or biological waste into waterways for years without government sanctions.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, Did you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day? When you went back across the green line, back to the open shore, was this just another day in a dirty war? When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed, one more home destroyed?
David Rovics, here in our Firehouse studio. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our viewers and listeners on this, the 36th anniversary of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
That's right. And yesterday here in New York, there were actions throughout the day around the United Nations calling attention to this fact. On June 6, 1967, Israeli forces captured the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. 36 years later, the occupation continues. In less than a month, Israeli forces killed or seriously injured three international peace activists working in the occupied territories, in addition to the many Palestinians who have been hurt. On March 16th, Rachel Corrie attempted to block a bulldozer from destroying the home of a Palestinian doctor in the Gaza town of Rafah. Rachel was 23 years old. Eyewitnesses say she was sitting directly in the path of the bulldozer, holding a megaphone, wearing a fluorescent jacket, as the driver advanced towards her. The bulldozer continued forward, ran over Rachel, crushing her with the lowered bulldozer blade, and then backed up over her and ran over her again. A U.S. congressional resolution demanding an independent inquiry into Rachel's death has been buried in committee, leaving the Israeli military's investigation, which cleared itself of any wrongdoing, as the only official investigation. Rachel Corrie was set to graduate from Evergreen State College in Olympia next Friday.
Just weeks later, 24-year-old Brian Avery of New Mexico was shot in the face in Jenin. He has regained consciousness and is able to communicate by writing messages, but his face is said to be shattered with his tongue split in two. He remains in critical condition and may never speak again. Eyewitnesses and members of the ISM say Avery was shot by an Israeli tank. Israel said the shooting is under investigation. A week later, British peace activist Tom Herndl was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier. Wearing a bright orange vest, he was trying to help Palestinian children get out of the line of Israeli fire. Tom is now in a coma and suffers severe brain damage. The Israeli military announced on May 10th that all foreigners entering the Gaza Strip will be required to sign waivers absolving the Israeli army from any responsibility if it shoots them.
In a few minutes, we are going to be joined by Tom Herndl's father in Britain. The Herndls have just moved Tom from Israel to Britain, where he remains in a coma. We are also going to be joined by a young Palestinian woman who survived the Sabra and Shatila refugee camp massacre in 1982. She was 4 years old. Both her parents were killed. But right now, we are joined by the Coreys, Rachel's parents, Craig and Cindy Corey, who are here in New York for the activities that took place yesterday around the 36th anniversary of the occupation. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. At this point, what kinds of investigations have been done, and what are you calling for?
We actually don't know of any investigation that's been done. There is a report that came out from, I think it's called a command report, that came out from the IDF shortly after Rachel was killed. That, unfortunately, that report was not preceded by an investigation to as best we can figure out. It did not quote any eyewitnesses. It did not make reference to Rachel's autopsy. It essentially had no substance to it. So at this point, all we know, I believe shortly after Rachel died, I think on the 19th of March, Richard Boucher, in a daily press briefing from the State Department, said that Prime Minister Sharon has assured President Bush that the Israeli government will undertake a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation and report the results to the United States. That has not yet happened. So an invisible investigation is not what I had in mind when I heard transparent investigation. Also, Mr. Boucher went on in that same press conference to say that when we have the death of an American citizen, we want to see it fully investigated. That is one of our key responsibilities overseas, to look after the welfare of American citizens and find out what happened in situations like these. So we at that time were calling for an independent American investigation. We still call for an independent American investigation. I expect to see a thorough Israeli investigation as well. I think that when you have this violent an action by one of our allied countries, it demands a thorough investigation. I think that's what any father would expect to have happen for their daughter. That's what I expect and Cindy expects to have happen for ours.
What kind of contacts have you had with either the State Department or representatives of the Israeli government, if any?
After Rachel died, probably the day following, there was a consul general from the Israeli consulate in San Francisco, I believe, who did make a phone call, which my son took. And my son explained that the gentleman seemed genuinely upset about what had happened, but and said that he, regretted what had happened. But that he didn't agree with Rachel's politics, and it was just an awkward time. My son felt that the man didn't understand Rachel and her politics, and so that was really the only direct contact we had, although I did contact the same gentleman after Tom Herndahl was injured, just because that day was probably the worst day I had had since Rachel's death. It felt like it was happening to me all over again. And I did talk with the gentleman. I called him and just explained that this seemed like such unnecessary, terrible violence, and I wanted it to stop. We have had information from the State Department that indicates that the ambassador of Israel was called to the State Department after Rachel was killed. There has been continuing contact between the U.S. State Department and the Israeli embassy in Washington, and also in Israel, between the embassy there and between the Israeli government.
Yesterday, were you able to go into the United Nations?
We attended a forum, and I spoke at the forum in the United Nations Plaza area. And then a gentleman from the division, a Palestinian division, did take us into the UN and to their office. And he explained that this is a unit that works on the plight of Palestine, and he explained that 10 years ago there was a unit that worked on South Africa in the same way, and that now has disappeared, and that he hopes that at some future time this problem will have some resolution, and that their division, in fact, can disappear as well. So we did get into the UN in that respect.
I see you're both wearing a pin with a picture of your daughter Rachel. What does it say?
It says, end the occupation. And, of course, Rachel was there nonviolently resisting in Gaza with Palestinian people who were also resisting nonviolently and trying to bring an end to this occupation. It also has a photograph of Rachel and her birth date, April 10th, 1979, and the day of her death, March 16th, 2003.
We're talking to Rachel's parents, Craig and Cindy Corey. She was killed by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to protect the home of a Palestinian doctor in Rafah, in Gaza. This day, we have this discussion on the 36th anniversary of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. When we come back, we will also be joined by Tom Herndl's father and by a young Palestinian woman who lost both her parents in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and our website is democracynow.org. If you want further information and to see further contacts on various groups that are involved with these issues, stay with us. Too many martyrs, Kim and Reggie Harris here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Today, the 36th anniversary of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. We are joined by the parents of Rachel Corey, Craig and Cindy Corey. We are also going to be speaking with a Palestinian woman who now lives in this country. She was four in 1982 when her family was killed at the Shatila refugee camp in southern Lebanon. They are Palestinians. And we're joined on the telephone by Anthony Herndl, father of Tom Herndl. Juan Gonzalez, also here, co-host on Democracy Now. Anthony Herndl, welcome to Democracy Now.
Hello there.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us where you are now?
We're back in London. We brought Tom back last week, having spent 6 weeks in Israel. And we're pretty glad to have him back here, although I'm afraid so he's not in a good way. He's in a deep coma still, and I'm afraid he's not likely to come out of it.
Can you tell us what happened to him, and then what happened to you when you went there? Pick him up?
Tom was with the same group, I think, as Rachel was with a few weeks later, and they were going down to place a tent at the end of a road where a tank would often come up at night and fire machine gun fire into the buildings around, and they decided to try and stop this by putting a tent where the tank would position itself. When they got down to the end of the road, just before they were going to place the tent, they stopped beside a roadblock or behind a roadblock because there was some fire coming in their direction. And there was a mound of sand. There were some children playing on the mound of sand. And Tom, when the gunfire started, went forward to take two of the children, or three sitting there or standing in the passageway, take them to safety. And so what happened was he managed to get one of them away. He went back for the other two, and as he leant forward to beckon or pick up the second of the three of them, he was shot through the head. And it's fairly clear that this was a deliberate shot. The question that we've had to face is whether this was an intended killing of, or attempted killing of an activist, peace activist, or whether it was just a shooting of a Palestinian in Israeli eyes. As far as I'm concerned, there's really no difference. But I think the Israelis would see it differently.
And what were you told by either the Israeli government or British officials about the circumstances of your son being shot?
Well, we were told very little. Sort of, the embassy told us a certain amount, and we managed to pick up quite a lot from the volunteers who we spoke to over the phone, and we then went down and met with them. But so far as the Israeli Defense Force is concerned, we got absolutely nothing from them for a very long time. Indeed, they refused to meet with us. And we made it very clear that all we wanted to do was to find out what had happened. And we were happy to entertain any explanation which made sense and to discuss with them what happened and to tell them what we found out. But they refused point blank to meet with us until literally 6 weeks later, the day after we were due to return with Tom, they offered us a meeting. So we postponed our departure and went to that meeting. In the meantime, we'd been given a report, or it wasn't really a report. It was a 20-page PowerPoint presentation which had been given to the British Embassy and which they then handed to us, which came up with a different version of events, so different as to be quite unbelievable. They described Tom as being, well, they didn't describe Tom necessarily, they described a gunman coming out of a building 100 yards away from where Tom was and beyond in a different range of buildings. And they suggest that this Palestinian came out of a building in the security zone and fired a pistol into the air three times and then fired it twice at the tower about 70 meters away. Now, no Palestinian would even go into that area without risking being shot. A Palestinian in the open with a pistol would be shot on sight. So the story doesn't hold good. It doesn't tally with any of the other versions of the story. I'm still in the process of finalizing the witness statements, which I've gathered from the witnesses. And there is no suggestion that there was any other fire of any sort that afternoon. So, you know, this is entirely implausible, the story. It's a different location. And it provides no explanation as to how Tom was shot, except they suggest that Tom might have been standing next to the gunman, or they might have shot him by mistake in some other way, thinking that he was the gunman. But those are their principal suggestions. But as I say, it's a completely different location, and it's a story which is clearly untrue. The only thing which comes out of it, which is helpful to us, is that they do admit that they deliberately shot somebody. They say that the commander of the tower from which he was shot was the person who fired the shot, and they admit that they did hit Tom. So those three things, I think, are useful to us because it does clarify one or two things which we were perhaps less sure about. We weren't quite sure which tower Tom was shot from, and there's now a fairly clear acceptance that they did shoot Tom, but the story they come up with is a fabrication.
When you, Anthony Herndl, went to pick up your son, you and your wife, you were traveling in a British embassy convoy, is that right?
Yes, that was. We went down three times to Rafa to collect evidence, to meet the people Tom was with. On the second trip down, each time we went down with the embassy in armored Range Rovers with diplomatic plates on them. The second time, we gave a warning 2 hours or 3 hours beforehand. The defense attaché told the IDF liaison officer that we would be there and gave a rough time. And 10 minutes before we approached the crossing, which is in the middle of Gaza, there's a crossing called Abu Hule. As we went through after that warning, we were fired on. There was a shot as we passed. And we had the ridiculous situation that we had to stop. We weren't clear what was intended. There was a pillbox with no soldier evident. These are armored pillboxes. And the political attaché in the first car had to get out with his hands above his head holding his passport to try and find out what they wanted. We had no idea. There was no explanation. There was no tannoy. There was nothing. They subsequently claimed that we should have stopped, and this is a crossing where if anybody goes through there knows that it's either an open or shut crossing. If it's open, vehicles pass through in a stream without stopping. If it's closed, they can't go through. It's not a checkpoint where there's a soldier present who checks your papers or anything of that sort.
So you're saying the Israeli military? You're saying the Israeli military fired on the British embassy convoy?
Well, they fired a shot over, we imagine it was over, we imagine it was a warning shot. Their explanation afterwards was that it was a shot in warning because we should have stopped. So it was clearly an embassy car, two embassy cars, clearly marked. And whether they did it deliberately as some sort of gesture, which is not inconceivable, I don't know. But there was absolutely no reason to shoot fire at that point. There was no danger to anybody. And it's two embassy cars of which they've been warned twice, once just 10 minutes before. So it's an extraordinary situation, and it just shows how out of control these people are.
Well, we have in our studio here also the parents of Rachel Corey we've been talking with. I'd like to get back for a second to ask Cindy Corey. Tell us a little bit about Rachel, what kind of a person she was, what prompted her to go to the occupied territories, and how you felt about her being there.
Rachel had been a student at the Evergreen State College. She'd lived in Olympia, Washington all her life. Our family and our community was really connected to the larger world. We had foreign exchange students that lived with us, three of them, while Rachel was in high school. As a young high school student, she made a trip to Russia for 6 weeks, and we had first had a Russian student stay with us. Students came from Eastern Russia with their teacher and were in our community for 3 months, and then Rachel went there for 6 weeks and lived in the home of the student that had been with us. That was a life-changing event for her. I I think she saw firsthand the suffering of the Russian people at that time, and she recognized what privilege she had being a young white American, and I think it really changed her outlook forever. While she was in Olympia as a student, she also felt a need to connect to the working world, and she had worked in the mental health area for 3 years while she was going to school. So she had connected to her community, too. And then 9/11 happened, and she felt that she needed to take some action, and she became a serious activist at that time, connected to four or five different peace groups that were working in the community. One of them was focused on justice for Palestine. And through that group and through interactions with people at the college that and with people that had been in Palestine, she started studying, learning. She connected with ISM people, and then eventually came to us and said, I need to do this. I need to go there. And all her life, well, maybe not all her life, but I remember reading something when she was younger, when she said, I know there's something important that I need to do. But I could tell from what she had written that she had a certain amount of angst in trying to figure out how to get there, how to determine what that was. But I think she found what it was. Sometime last year, she came to us and told us that she was going to go. It was, of course, startling for us. We had not been nearly as connected to this issue. We'd heard about it, of course, all our lives, but had not been so connected to us. So it was very startling. But I knew my daughter. I knew that if she had come to this decision, that she was going to go. And so I embraced it and tried to learn about it myself, and saw Rachel in December, and she left in January.
Did she write to you while she was there?
She wrote emails to us, and actually we had more email communication during that period than we had had earlier, mostly, and we also had phone communication with her while she was there. And the emails, I think, provided a real awakening to us about what the occupation really meant to people on a human level. Rachel had an ability, I think, to bring people and to bring situations to life, and she did that in those emails. And I received some, other friends received some, and then I would pass them on to other family members. And I remember talking to my son. I think my two other children they were terribly worried about her, and probably even more skeptical about her going than I. But I remember saying to my son after I had sent some email to him, what do you think? And he said, well, she's telling us, giving us a perspective that I've never really heard before or understood before.
I'd like to echo that and something that Anthony said, because when I started reading Rachel's emails, and I'm a Vietnam War veteran, I curiously enough was in charge of bulldozers in Vietnam in 1970 with the 1st Air Cavalry Division, so I have some experience with seeing an army, and in fact an occupying army in that sense. But reading Rachel's emails and understanding what she was doing there, reading about her having to stay with families in the back of their apartment because the front was all shot through full of holes. Reading about some of the activities she was trying to do, protecting water supplies, trying to retrieve bodies with people shooting at her feet, not over her head, but at her feet. And remember that I was taught to shoot low, a poor shot like myself, because if you miss, it'll ricochet and hit the person. So I was terribly frightened for Rachel, and in fact found it very difficult to write her. I only managed to write her an email once, although I too talked to her on the telephone, in fact, more than I did when she was in the United States.
Would you like to read us an email?
Oh, sure.
I have one that I think was republished in The Guardian.
Okay.
The piece is called Rachel's War.
Hi, friends and family and others. I have been in Palestine for 2 weeks and 1 hour now, and I still have very few words to describe what I see. It is most difficult for me to think about what's going on here when I sit down to write back to the United States. Something about the virtual portal into luxury. I don't know if many of the children here have ever existed without tank shell holes in their walls and the towers of an occupying army surveying them constantly from the near horizons. I think, although I'm not entirely sure, that even the smallest of these children understand that life is not like this everywhere. An 8-year-old was shot and killed by an Israeli tank 2 days before I got here, and many of the children murmur his name to me, Ali, or point at the posters of him on the walls. The children also love to get me to practice my limited Arabic by asking me, Kaif Sharon, Kaif Bush, and they laugh when I say, Bush Majnoon, Sharon Majnoon, back in my limited Arabic. How is Sharon? How is Bush? Bush is crazy. Sharon is crazy. Of course, this isn't quite what I believe, and some of the adults who have the English correct me. Bush Mish Majnoon. Bush is a businessman. Today I tried to learn to say Bush is a tool, but I don't think it translated quite right. But anyway, there are 8-year-olds here, much more aware of the workings of the global power structure than I was just a few years ago. Nevertheless, no amount of reading, attendance at conferences, documentary viewing, and word of mouth could have prepared me for the reality of the situation here. You just can't imagine it unless you see it. And even then, you are always well aware that your experience of it is not at all the reality. What with the difficulties the Israeli army would face if they shot an unarmed U.S. citizen, and with the fact that I have money to buy water when the army destroys wells, and the fact, of course, that I have the option of leaving. Nobody in my family has been shot driving in their car by a rocket launcher from a tower at the end of a major street in my hometown. I have a home. I am allowed to go see the ocean. When I leave for school or work, I can be relatively certain that there will not be a heavily armed soldier waiting halfway between Mud Bay and downtown Olympia at a checkpoint with the power to decide whether I can go about my business and whether I can get home again when I'm done. As an afterthought to all this rambling, I am in Rafa, a city of about 140,000 people, approximately 60% of whom are refugees, many of whom are twice or three times refugees. Today, as I walked on top of the rubble where homes once stood, Egyptian soldiers called to me from the other side of the border, "Go, go," because a tank was coming, and then waving and, "What's your name?" Something disturbing about this friendly curiosity. It reminded me of how much, to some degree, we are all kids, curious about other kids. Egyptian kids shouting at strange women wandering into the paths of tanks. Palestinian kids shot from the tanks when they peek out from behind walls to see what's going on. International kids standing in front of tanks with banners. Israeli kids in the tanks anonymously, occasionally shouting, and also occasionally waving, many forced to be here, many just aggressive, shooting into the houses as we wander away. I've been having trouble accessing news about the outside world here, but I hear an escalation of war on Iraq is inevitable. There is a great deal of concern here about the reoccupation of Gaza. Gaza is reoccupied every day to various extents, but I think the fear is that the tanks will enter all the streets and remain here instead of entering some of the streets and then withdrawing after some hours or days to observe and shoot from the edges of the communities. If people aren't already thinking about the consequences of this war for the people of the entire region, then I hope you will start. My love to everyone. My love to my mom. My love to Smooch, my love to FG and Barnhair and Sesame's and Lincoln School, my love to Olympia.
The letter of Rachel Corey, read by her mother Cindy Corey, here with Craig Corey, her mother and father, in the studios of Democracy Now. On the telephone with us, Anthony Herndl, father of Tom Herndl, who was shot by an Israeli soldier in Gaza and is in a deep coma now. He's just been moved from Israel and the occupied territories to his home in Britain. When we come back from our break, we will also be joined by Rafif Ziada. When she saw the Coreys today, she said, "They're my honorary parents." Rafif was 4 years old in the Shatila refugee camp in southern Lebanon with her parents. They are Palestinians. Her parents were killed as she hid under a bed, and she then traveled from one country to another with relatives and ended up in the United States and is in Washington and is one of those who spoke this past Sunday when Noam Chomsky gave a speech at the University of District of Columbia. David Rovix joins us also in the studio, who's going to sing a song about Rafif, and we'll be back.
Daddy was an Arab from Bezlava, situation so unkind. My mama was a refugee from Ramallah, had to leave her land behind. I grew up in this refugee camp, in this unwelcome land. In this little parcel of Lebanon, we were dealt a losing hand. Then one day the soldiers came, a tired old refrain. I'll try to tell you what happened next, but there's no way to explain. Soldiers raped my mother, then they killed her dead, along with the rest of the Shatila camp, while I hid beneath my bed. Now I'm a wandering, no place to call my home. All around the world I roam. My aunt came over from Jordan, brought me there to live, and together we've moved to half the world. Oh, for peace, what I would give. Beirut, Greece, and New York town, I've watched the world churn, but my home is Palestine. Someday I will return. But I'm a wandering, no place to call my home. Palestine, all around the world I This is my situation here in the heart of the empire. Sent the copters and bulldozers, turned Ramallah to a funeral pyre. You've heard my story, time will not allow. Soon my visa will expire, what will you do now? 'Cause I'm a wandering, no place to call my home. All around the world I roam.
David Rovix, here in our Firehouse studio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue on this 36th anniversary of the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, joined by the parents of Rachel Corey, Craig and Cindy Corey, who are in New York for this anniversary observance, spending time speaking at different events and trying to go to the United Nations. Rachel Corey, who died on March 16th of this year, the first international protester, killed by Israeli forces. She was run over by
crushed by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to protect a Palestinian home from demolition. Also on the phone with us, Tom Herndl's father, Anthony Herndl. Tom Herndl in a deep coma. He was shot in the head as he was trying to protect some Palestinian children in Gaza. And in the studio with us now is Rafif Ziada. She lives in Washington, D.C., and she is one of the survivors of the Shatila refugee camp massacre. On September 18, 1982, the Lebanese Christian militia forces, allied with Israeli military forces, slaughtered up to 2,000 unarmed Palestinians at the two refugee camps, Sabra and Shatila, outside Beirut. The massacre unfolded over 3 days when Israel allowed its Lebanese Christian phalangist militia into the refugee camps. Many of the victims were stabbed. A large number of women were murdered. The man who is now the Prime Minister of Israel, General Sharon, was in overall command of the forces at the time. He claimed there were 2,000 terrorists in the camps, but the subsequent Israeli government commission, the Kahan Commission, which investigated the massacres, reported that Israeli troops surrounding the camps knew what was happening. The Israeli inquiry also found Sharon indirectly responsible, and he was forced to resign. Rafif, when I saw you come into the studio and the Corys came in, you said they were your honorary parents. Why?
First time I ever met Cindy, we were having a vigil for Rachel outside the Israeli embassy, and it was a really horrifying sight because Cindy came and the Israeli flag was waving on top of us, and I just told her I lost my family as well, and she had lost a daughter, and I'm exactly Rachel's age, so they've become my honorary adopted family.
You're wearing a t-shirt that says, "We are all Palestinians."
This is actually not meant to be worn by Palestinians, but by people in this country and activists around the world to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people, because what Rachel and Tom saw and what happened to them has been happening to the Palestinian people since the creation of the State of Israel. Dispossession, curfews, land confiscation, land theft. This is what we go through on a daily basis, and it's got to stop. And I think activists in this country have to take responsibility. The bulldozer that killed Rachel was a caterpillar bulldozer supplied by this country, by this government, by U.S. tax money. And it's up to activists in this country to act, to take responsibility.
Could you tell us a little bit about what happened to you after the massacre and how you ended up here? We've heard a little bit in the summary, but in terms of your own experience.
I'd rather not get into the details of what happened, but like every Palestinian after it, we were just roaming all around the world. We went to about 22 countries. We were deported out of 15 of them to being Palestinian, because what people don't realize is that around the world, any incident that happens in any country, they usually blame on the Palestinians, because we're the most defenseless crowd. We have no state, we have no government to protect us. So every time an incident takes place, they say, let's round up the usual suspects, and those are usually the Palestinians. So we were deported out of 15 countries for simply being Palestinian. And finally, I ended up in the U.S. To do my master's. September 11th happened, and everything after that, of course, was horrendous with terrorism and how are you going to school, and people were just making absurd jokes constantly until finally I graduated and I started working with Sustain, which is Stop U.S. Tax-Funded Aid to Israel Now in D.C.
Rafif was 4 years old when her mother and father were killed. She's asked not to talk about it herself, suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome. She was hiding under a bed and was discovered a few years later. The family that you traveled from state to state, country to country with, was it your family? Was it relatives?
They're relatives, yes.
And do they live in the United States now?
No, they are not even allowed to come to the United States. They tried to get a visa to come see my graduation, and they weren't allowed to come. They're completely stateless, so they have no papers and no records of anything. They don't even have refugee cards.
Let me ask Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey. So often children, just as parents teach their children, as children get older, they teach their parents. Did you know about the occupied territories, about Israel? Were you involved in the issue? Did you have a different
view of what was going on before your daughter went?
I have said since this happened that I think the majority of Americans are blind to what's happening in Palestine. We didn't have a direct connection there. I think Jewish Americans in this country feel a direct connection. Palestinian Americans certainly do. But we didn't have that. Through the years, I read stories to Rachel about the Holocaust, about things that had happened. I think our allegiance was there with Israel through the years, but we were just listening to the news reports like other people do, day after day after day, and not getting the kind of detailed information about what the occupation really means to people. And it really took, I think, for me, hearing from Rachel and hearing about the homes that she was living in, hearing what that children, aren't able to walk safely to school, and that some days they can't go to school at all. Hearing about the curfews in which people are confined to their homes. Hearing about the municipal water workers who, even though they had secured permission to be out there, were still being harassed with gunfire from the towers above, so that they asked the ISM volunteers to come out, and the internationals went out with their banners and megaphones to try to let the workers repair the wells. And she slept at wells at night in order to try to prevent their demolition. The house that she was trying to protect is one of just many houses in that Gaza
area. Whose house
was it? He's called a doctor, Dr. Samir Masri, I think is his last name. But he has a wife and three children. Rachel had gotten to know those children. She had sat on, they had a TV, and she talked about watching on Saturday morning, gummy bears dubbed into Arabic, and sitting in this puddle of blankets with this family, and their house just happened to be in line for demolition. Many others have been demolished in that area because the Israelis are putting up a wall out there and clearing an area, a 100-meter area, in order to have a buffer. And so these houses just keep coming down. In fact, I looked at the last human rights report out May 22nd to 28. 15 more houses came down that week in Gaza.
If I can ask you we have about a minute left. If you could tell us what you would like for the listeners or viewers who are very active in a variety of causes to do in terms of what kind of pressure they can bring to bear to have justice done in the case of your daughter and the others who have the other international observers, as well as the situation in the occupied territories generally.
Well, I think right now our focus is on the U.S. Congress. That's where they're paying the bills, spending a great deal of money on funding this, what happens in Palestine. We would like to see support for HCR 111, which is a resolution that has been introduced into committee. It's now in committee in Congress, in the House of Representatives. It calls for U.S. involvement in an independent investigation of Rachel's death, and it also calls on the U.S. to work with the Israeli government to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again. And we feel that people can bring attention to the entire issue by keeping Rachel's issue out there right now.
I'd like to say you can also write, call, email to the State Department, to the Israeli Embassy, and to the White House to make this known. And I'd like to see support, educate yourself on the entire Palestinian situation to support both of our daughters now.
And the website of Sustain, Rafif?
SustainCampaign.org.
SustainCampaign.org. I want to thank you all for being with us. Rachel's parents, Cindy and Craig Corey, Anthony Herndle, father of Tom Herndle, and Rafif Ziada with Sustain in Washington. That does it for the program. Our website, democracynow.org. You can get a copy of the show, 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Noah Reibel, Rich Kim, and Mike DeFilippo, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.